So we'll start with our motivation. And from the time we open our eyes in the morning, maybe even before that, till the time we slip into unconsciousness every night, there's just like this underlying pulse, this drumbeat of I want something to make me happy. I want to be away from the thing that makes me unhappy. And this pulse, this mind, drives us from life to life to life. And although we kind of rely on it as something that will lead us to happiness, if we analyze our experience at all, we can see that it doesn't produce what we're going for. And this is the great tragedy, really, of our confusion. That throughout this life, we can see it. Throughout beginningless lives that we can't remember. We've been striving for happiness and not reaching it because we're looking at it in all the wrong places. That's true for us every day of our lives. It's true for every living being. And we can see it in the turkeys, we can see it in the cats, much more easily, really, because they don't mask it. They're just going for it. So we have had the great fortune in this life for all the conditions to come together to actually get some understanding and some teachings on where that kind of craving mind leads us, what the antidotes to that are, and what the source, true happiness, lasting happiness actually is. And so that's just incredible that these conditions have come together at this time. And when we look at our own experience, then we can extrapolate to those all around us, and our compassion can really arise for the situation that all of us are in. So as we share the Dharma tonight, let's think about this condition of cyclic existence. Let's think about the kindness of all the living beings around us and how we share this craving for happiness, craving to be free of suffering, and we also share this general lack of happiness. But we also share the potential to be able to completely come out of this cycle, to fulfill our potential completely, to have lasting happiness that goes on and on forever. And set our goal to achieve that ourselves so that we can bring every living being to that same state. So cultivating our bodhicitta so that we can become Buddhas, so that we have every skill that's necessary to bring all beings out of the suffering. So set that as our motivation tonight. So, well, Venerable Chidren is at the monastic conference this week, along with several members of our community. She, you know, usually when she leaves an assignment, say, oh, you know, work on this. But this time she said, you can figure it out. So I've really been struck with these teachings on Aryadeva. Everyone here has commented on how powerful these teachings are. And one of the things that I've really seen through the course of these many weeks is how it seems so far in the teachings on Aryadeva, how he keeps coming at the delusions or the afflictions in all these different directions. But the theme so far keeps being about our ignorance, our anger, our attachment. Our ignorance, our anger, our attachment. Round and round and round. And so in this last series, just in the last few weeks, Venerable Chödrön had this quote, when a bodhisattva wants to be a benefit, this is an introduction to this latest chapter, when a bodhisattva wants to be a benefit, what obstructs them? The afflictions. Principally the three poisons of confusion, attachment, and anger. And so, and she said then, and I've really been thinking about it, it's really, really true. You know, everybody that comes to the Dharma teachings, everybody that comes to the Abbey, everybody sitting here tonight has this really genuine wish to overcome the things that are obstacles in ourselves, and a really genuine wish to be of benefit to other living beings. And what gets in the way of it over and over and over? Well, grasping for my happiness. So we can look at it in terms of our self-grasping, we can look at it in terms of our self-centeredness that comes right out of that, and then our anger and attachment that come right out of that. So, you know, since all of cyclic existence is perpetuated by our afflictions, it seems like a very, very, very important thing to want to come overcome. And yet, as many years as many of us have been receiving teachings, these afflictions just are so huge in our minds. So I particularly wanted to look at attachment tonight. Partly because of the three, you know, anger gets kind of a lot of attention. It is, of course, of the three, it is the only one that not only actively gets in the way of our achieving things, but it actually destroys our merit when it comes up. So it's really deadly. But Venerable Chödrön wrote a whole book on it. His Holiness the Dalai Lama wrote a whole book on it. Shantideva's Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life has a whole chapter on its antidote. He doesn't have a whole chapter on the antidote to attachment. Unless you look at the whole book as an antidote to attachment, which in some ways it is. And then, you know, in this whole section where Venerable's been talking about how a teacher guides students according to their propensities, and she had us, you know, raise our hands and say, are you more inclined to anger or attachment? And you know, attachment, definitely I can identify with, she said with a shrug, like it was no big deal. And then, a couple of weeks ago, she was describing a person who has attachment. Is a person who likes fun, flirtation, flowers, beautiful music, a connoisseur of fine things. They're extravagant. They love to go out and have a good time. They're very greedy. They're clever. They're good with words. I thought, oh my God. Spent my whole life in pursuit of these things, which I've thought about before, but not quite so like pointed in that list of having spent my whole life in really wanting the best music and cultivating a taste for really fine foods. like this is something you're supposed to do, cultivating a taste for good coffee, going to the theater, knowing what, blah, 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 blah. So I thought, you know, you really need to spend some time looking at attachment again. So I'm going to just share all that, because I did. And so, in a way, it's going to be a review, because we've all heard so many teachings on attachment. But just looking at my own experience, I mean, certainly when I met the Dharma and spent a lot of time again, 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 receiving teachings on the Four Noble Truths and hearing what the Buddha said about the nature of cyclic existence, the unsatisfactory nature, and that the cause of that is, in fact, our delusions and karma. Well, it's true. I know it's true. I've examined it to be true. And I still behave like I don't know it's true. I mean, I've moved to the Abbey and then certainly separated from many, many objects of attachment. But if I look at where my mind is going all day, there's more room for looking at what, how deadly attachment is. So I just wanted to share that with us tonight. So even if, when she said, you know, raise your hand if you're more into anger than you are into attachment, even if you raised your hand on that one, we all have all of them. So it's not, like, irrelevant if that's, if anger is your favorite mode. I want to talk about my sources tonight. So I went through Venerable Children's teachings on Aryadeva from the last, the last 2 or 3 months. Some of my notes, and then I reviewed some of the whole teachings. I also, because this happened to be the week that the SAFE program is also looking at attachment, SAFE 1A, so I reviewed the talk from the SAFE program that Venerable Chödrön gave on attachment for sharing the Dharma Day when she was teaching on Open Heart, Clear Mind. So that was also very helpful. Jeffrey Hopkins has been teaching the Abbey community about the afflictions, so I went back through my Jeffrey notes and also relied a little bit on meditation on emptiness. A little bit from Alex Berzin, and also a book by Chagdur Tulku Rinpoche called The Four Gates to Buddhist Practice, or Gates to Buddhist Practice, which is a really wonderful overview of kind of the foundational things. So originally in my notes I had cited all my sources and could, you know, say who said what. Now they're all scrambled up and I can't tell you. But anyway, those are the many things that I pulled from in order to do this. And I wanted to also say one wonderful thing from Chagdur Tulku about that makes me think that Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, the whole book, is about overcoming our desire or our attachment. He says, now, right now, we are afflicted with me, my, mine-itis, a condition caused by ignorance. He said, our self-centeredness and our self-interest have become very strong habits, and to change that, we just need to refocus. Instead of always focusing on I, change to you, them, or others. And if we expand our attachment to our own happiness until we have an attachment to the happiness of all, that's the journey. That's the journey. So that way, in a way, we're using the desire that is an affliction, transforming that desire, an afflicted desire, into a wish that we really want everyone to have happiness, and that becomes our focus. So indeed, the Bodhisattva way of life is overcoming our attachment to our own happiness and creating a wish that everybody be happy. I like that. So let's go back to what is attachment. And before I do that, Jeffrey, in Meditation on Emptiness, he uses desire as the poison. That's the translation that he uses. And he uses attachment as the word that we call craving in the 12 links of dependent arising. So this sent me on a journey to really look at if I could find the how many Tibetan words were matched up with the things that we called attachment, things we called craving, things we called desire. I found quite a few, and I didn't have time to really match them up. But they all, you know, in English, they're quite interchangeable. And it looks like in some ways in Tibetan they are too, until you get quite technically down to some fine details. So there are more gradations of this attachment and desire in Tibetan than I find in the English teachings that we get. And I'm kind of fascinated with that. But they seem to be all gradations of the same. You know, there's that basic desire, which becomes craving, or basic attachment, which becomes craving, which becomes grasping. So it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger the more tighter we cling. This is my interpretation of what I found. This is not an absolute fact. So, from the definition from Meditation on Emptiness, desire perceives an internal or external contaminated phenomenon to be pleasant from the point of view of its own entity and thereupon seeks it. In other words, desire perceives a phenomena contaminated by ignorance to be pleasant from its own side and goes after it. It has the function of generating suffering. That's its function. Like oil that has set in cloth, desire adheres to its object of observation and thus is difficult to separate from it. So desire goes for its object, sticks. And then it says the reason that's for stating that the function of desire is the generation of suffering is that the root of all suffering is birth. Yes? And the main cause of birth in cyclic existence is desire or attachment. So, you know, when we have our talks and when we give our talks about desire and attachment, we use chocolate cake a lot as the example. And, you know, it's a good example because a lot of people are attached to chocolate cake. But truthfully, what are we talking about? A poison so deep that it continually propels our existence in cyclic existence. That makes chocolate cake sound kind of light. Kind of irrelevant. And yet it's that same mind of clinging, grasping that goes after the chocolate cake is the one that's going after the rebirth. It's just stronger and stronger and stronger. So if we can antidote it on any of those levels, we're starting to get a handle on what this mind is about. Desire's activity is acquisition. It's the mind of I want. Give me. I want not just chocolate cake, I want more love. I want more acknowledgement. I want more fun. I want more appreciation. I want more cats. I want more money. I want more praise. I want, constant. Just more comfort, more warmth. So desire's activity is to acquire people, objects, fame, reputation, praise, and so forth. So going back to what Venerable Chodron said originally, she said in her talk on Sharing the Dharma Day, she said, before we can talk about attachment, we have to look again at where we think happiness and suffering come from. That's where we're hooked. We think it all comes from outside. No matter how many years we've heard this teaching, we think it comes from outside. It's the force of our ignorance. It's the power of our ignorance that makes us not be able to hear it. Go, oh no, happiness is internal. The happiness isn't in the chocolate cake. We don't just go, oh yeah, right, and change our lives. It's deep. It's really, really deep. And we constantly think that something beautiful outside, something comfortable outside, something pleasant outside, that thing out there is the source of the happiness. That happiness comes from having the things we want, being near the people we care about, being in the place we like, not being near the things we don't like. And then our purpose of our life becomes trying to change the external and the internal environment all day long. Is that true for you? I mean, it's really true for me. I hated reading this. I hated thinking about it. It's like it's true. The unconscious motivating force is constantly trying to rearrange things so that I'm comfortable. I'm okay. I'm comfortable. I'm happy. And so, you know, when we say that when we have a thought of concern for another, that's a genuine wish, we should really rejoice. Because it's a big break in that chain. But underneath, we're constantly going for that happiness, 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 happiness from morning to night. That's what we're trying to do. And, you know, we're so used to doing it. We've been doing it for so long that to stay aware of it is even quite difficult. So the same thing, you know, we see suffering also is coming from the outside. You know, mostly if we're unhappy, it's because, why? Somebody did something. You, right. No, you. Right. Right. And so that we try to just like either get away from or destroy it. So that's the other thing we're doing all day long. That becomes the meaning and the purpose of our life. Doesn't that sound kind of bleak? Also unsuccessful. Mostly unsuccessful. Venerable calls this the bubblegum mind, this mind of attachment. And it's I think a beautiful image. If we can hang on to it. The chief attribute of bubblegum, she said, is that it sticks. The second attribute is that you blow a big bubble and it blows up in your face. So these two qualities of bubblegum are like attachment. Right, so looking back in your life, right, so bubblegum sticks. So we get an idea that something is going to make us happy. And we kind of blow up this big bubble about it. I mean, we can make it chocolate cake. There it is on the table. It's fresh. It's still steaming a little bit. We've had it before. It's Venerable Yeshe's special chocolate cake with zucchini in it, so that it doesn't sound so good, but what it is, it's really moist and delicious. Right? There's a bubble. We know it's going to be fantastic chocolate cake. There goes the bubble. And then, depending on how big we blow that bubble, the potential for it to pop is huge. So on one hand, you can just say, okay, she forgot the salt, or she forgot the sugar. We're disappointed and now we're mad at her. But on the other hand, you can look at the worse, kind of longer term difficulties with that chocolate cake, and it actually puts on weight, it's not so good for our heart, our blood, you know, blood sugar goes up, all these things that are the defects of the cake, but we don't see any of that. If you eat it in the afternoon and you're not so good with chocolate, you're up all night, we don't think of that. It blows up in our face. And in a much more kind of real example, Venerable, when she was giving this teaching, she said, look back in your life at everything you thought was going to be stupendous and wonderful. What happened? How long did the happiness last? So it's an interesting thought. Yeah, I know. I don't want to hear any more. It's an interesting thought. How long has the happiness lasted? And where is it now? For every single thing that we can, you know, can remember going, poo, blow. And then what? We have a big bubble with bubble gum all over a place. So in the process of getting it, in the process of blowing it up, we've created all this negative karma. And then when it's all over, even it was happy, even it was successful, even the bubble didn't blow so badly that you just have this big mess all over your face, when it's over, how do we actually feel? A little kind of disappointed. Maybe it wasn't as good as it was supposed to be. Or a little out of sorts because now it's gone. It's over. Wasn't supposed to leave. Surely it should have lasted this long. So even at its best, it leaves us disappointed. Can't remember what show it's from. Is that all there is? If that's all there is, then let's keep dancing. I mean, right? If that's all there is, what can we do? Keep dancing. If that's where we think the source of our happiness is. So in that case, then, back to Aryadeva, he says, desire is no friend, but it seems like one. which is why you do not fear it. But shouldn't people particularly rid themselves of a harmful friend? This is even a painful thought, you know, to think that someone really cares about you, someone you've trusted, you've told all your secrets, you've given them the keys to your apartment, someone that you really care about a lot, and then you find out that this person has been stealing your stuff. This person has been trashing you all over the world. This person has been betraying you behind your back. I mean, that hurts worse than any forthright enemy coming at you in your face. You know this person doesn't like you, but this person I loved, this person I trusted, this person who's betraying me is our attachment. The one who's lying to us the most, saying, oh yes, I'll make you happy. I'll make you happy. Cling to that person. Cling to that thing. Cling to that praise. Cling, 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 cling. And it's not true. But at the time, it feels kind of nice. We don't think it's a problem. How could it be a problem? I feel good. Isn't that what I'm supposed to do? Isn't that the opposite of being angry? Isn't that having a happy mind? I mean, that's where I get caught. Isn't that the goal, to have keep a happy mind? But if it's a happy mind based on trying to grasp at happiness externally, then we're just setting up ourselves for more problems. Desire is hard to recognize as something to discard, so exertion is necessary to abandon it. And if I have craving, there's no external means to eliminate it. It's only eliminated in my mind. So this is totally me. This is not from the text. But as I was thinking about it, it's like, for me, there's like four ways that attachment makes us suffer, or four kind of levels in which our attachment suffers and makes us suffer. And, you know, the antidote they always give first is meditation on death and impermanence, which we'll get to. But I personally think, from my own experience, that we have to do a lot of thinking about how insidious attachment is, how harmful attachment is, before we're even interested in antidoting it to begin with. And then, even so, we have to think about this a lot before the meditation on death and impermanence, I think, has an impact. That's certainly been true in my own mind. And so with that in mind, then for me, that one of the disadvantages of looking at these four different ways that it makes us suffer. First of all, attachment is painful when we can't get what we want or we're separated from what we like. We know that one. We tend to forget about it. But that's where the first kind of gross level pain comes from. We can't get what we want. That's painful. And then we're mad. So then we're off into anger and needing to do the antidotes to anger. But before that, we can antidote our attachment. The second level, and I think it's more, personally, I think it's more subtle, is that if I look at this mind, I want, I want, I want, the craving mind, the agitated mind, that's not a pleasant state of mind either. You know, there's the kind of giddiness that goes with that I associate with pleasure, but if I really spend time thinking about how that mind is, that's not comfortable either. It's not pleasure. Our attachment leads us into the 10 non-virtuous pathways of action. And so we create terrible karma for the future under its sway. And then it's this chief propeller of cyclic existence. That although attachment is the root, it's our attachment, our craving, our grasping that leads us to rebirth after rebirth after rebirth. So for me, those are like different levels of how deeply attachment poisons us. So let's look at that first one. Desire produces suffering and we can't get what we want. Aryadeva again. Desire is painful because of not getting. Right? I mean, we hardly need a commentary on this. Desire is painful because of not getting. We don't get what we want. We don't, or we're separated from what we love or what we like. That's painful. It's excruciating. We all know it very, very well. But we never, rarely, twig to the idea that the problem is not the not getting. The problem is not even the separating. The problem comes from being attached and to that very thing, thinking that there's some kind of happiness in it. It's the glomming on mind that's the problem. But we don't see it. And it's one chief way that the teachings tell us that we can know attachment is at work is that as soon as the circumstance changes, if we get unhappy, frustrated, angry, or sad, then we know attachment was there. Even if we didn't see it beforehand, as soon as something gets in the way of our happiness, if we respond with an aversion reaction, if pain arises, then attachment was at work. Chagyachulpa Rinpoche has an interesting story about that separation in the mind. He says, so if two people go into a shop at the same time, and a watch shop, and buy the same watch, and one of them goes in with the mind that says, this is a really nice watch. It's impermanent. It will eventually break. But in the meantime, I'll really enjoy that this tells time. And puts on the watch and walks out. The other person looks at the watch and goes, wow, this is the most fantastic watch I've ever seen. This is the best watch I've ever had. I really want this watch. I want to pass this watch on to my children. Puts on the watch and leaves. When the watch breaks, who's unhappy? The one who was going to pass it on as the legacy to their children. The other person, oh, well, it was not going to last anyway. Now, it's easy to do with a watch. It's not easy to do with a beloved cat or our career or the things that, you know, we hold most dear, but it's the same mind. So it's the same thing, and this is part of its deception. In the long term, attachment always produces suffering. Why? Because everything is impermanent. Except emptiness and meaning generalities. And those are not things that we're clinging to so tightly, okay? An unobstructed space. Everything that we grasp onto is impermanent, is changing moment by moment by moment by moment, every single thing. So attachment can only cause us suffering eventually, no matter what. But in the short term, it's kind of pleasant. Feels nice. And so we don't see it. We just don't get it until we're slammed. I can't remember if this is Venerable Chögyam or Aryadeva, but we're... Gyaltsepche. When we can't recognize that when we have attachment, we're suffering. Not understanding that, constantly being focused on the external world and wanting it to change, that is the biggest suffering. That is the biggest suffering. So then there's the second point. This feeling of craving itself is not so pleasant. This is Geshe Sonam Rinchen. How can the obsessive state of mind associated with desire be called pleasurable? If desire itself were pleasurable, we wouldn't feel compelled to satisfy it. That's an interesting piece of logic. If desire itself were pleasurable, we wouldn't be trying to satisfy it all the time. It's like an itchy rash. Scratching it brings temporary relief, but only aggravates it in the long run. So desire lives and grows by being indulged. The more we chase after the very things that we're craving, even get them. It's not just the not getting, we get them. We're still having this agitated mind. Buddha has a wonderful analogy. Buddha compares desires to being in debt. If you owe money to the bank for your house every month, you have to pay. And in the end, you will own your house. That's very nice. With sensual desire, however, we cannot pay off the debt. They arise again and again. Hunger, thirst, lust for sex, wanting warmth, wanting coolness, they all come back again and again, and trying to fulfill our desires is like carrying the water to the sea, a never-ending task that is ultimately completely useless. So that's the thing about the analogy they say about drinking salt water. The thirst is never quenched. It just makes you thirstier and thirstier and thirstier. I like this comparison, though. You pay off your house, you get a house. Constantly trying to pay off your craving, you just get more craving. So then desire poisons our mind and makes us get involved in the 10 non-virtuous pathways of action. So think about this for a minute. This is a little exercise. Let's go through the 10 non-virtuous pathways of action and think in your mind which has influenced you more, anger or attachment, or desire to do these. Okay? Killing. Think about the killing in your own, things you've done in your own life, this life that you remember. More driven by desire or by anger? Desire for you? Desire? Anger for you? Aversion? No? Aversion for you? Yeah, for me it was desire. Yeah, much more. The clams I've dug, the limpets I've pried off a rock to eat, the worms I've killed so they don't mess up my nice vegetables in the garden, and all of that was out of attachment. Stealing. Desire or anger? Desire. Anger is possible. I've walked out on restaurant checks out of anger. But mostly desire. Okay. Sexual misconduct. Desire or anger? It's possible out of anger. Desire. Lying. Yeah, attachment to reputation. Although, is that really anger? You know, in the eight worldly concerns, it's craving for or craving to be separated from is one of the ways it's presented. So, craving for praise or craving to be separated from, to avoid blame or criticism. So it could be aversion arising from that. But I think in the way it works in me internally, I would say the craving not to be criticized is stronger than my aversion at criticism.
Yeah.
But lying, yes. Mostly, right, desire. Divisive speech. Let me say both for me.
Mine's a lot stronger with anger.
Yeah.
You're trying to get back at somebody or
something
to say. But often
the what to get back at has to do with.
Well, yeah.
Oh yeah, so getting back at somebody is anger, but wanting to get back at them has to do with your attachment to praise or your reputation or whatever.
Yeah, they've said that, you know, the greater attachment, the greater the anger. So we know that attachment is the driving force behind all of the anger.
Right. Well, it's interesting as we get into these. What about harsh speech? Attachment for you? How?
Well, because anger arises, or aversion arises, and then it comes out in harsh speech because I'm not getting what I want.
Anger arises, and it comes out in harsh speech because you're not getting what you want. Well, that makes sense. This was the one where I thought probably I felt more compelled by anger than by attachment, but I see what you mean. This is the only one on my list. Idle talk?
I'm an attachment.
Yeah, for me it's totally about attachment. Oh, let's sit and have tea and talk. Let's talk about our lives. Let's talk about our miseries. Let's talk. That's totally attachment for me. Coveting? Well, duh. Attachment. Ill will?
If exaggerating the negative qualities of somebody to the point where you just want to have something happen to them.
Yeah. So it could be attachment, but maybe that's more stewing anger. And then wrong views. Who knows? Attachment to wrong views, though, is something quite strong in us, I think. So, you know, it was an interesting exercise to really think about what actually propels my negative action. Even though I'm much more diligent, vigilant about anger, it causes more destruction, blatant and, you know, overtly. It also upsets my reputation overtly. but really, if I looked at these 10 non-virtues, it's desire that's propelling them. And then the fourth one, at the time of death, craving is what does us in, right? Craving and grasping. From Meditation on Emptiness, Jeffrey's talking about the 12 links of dependent arising. He's talking about the potency of karma on our mind stream is actualized by attachment, grasping, and existence at the time of death. So the eighth branch, or the eighth link in the 12 links of dependent arising, attachment, is a desire not to separate from a feeling of pleasure, to separate from a feeling of pain, and for a non-diminishment of neutral feeling. So that's the technical definition. I also know that we're grasping for existence at that time, right? Also, we're not wanting to separate from the body. We're not wanting to separate from the ego identity. We're not wanting to separate from the things that we love that are all around us. So, you know, it's quite vivid, our craving, our desire at the time of death. Okay, so if satisfying desire does not end the desire, what does? If satisfying desire does not end desire, what does?
Not having desire.
Not having desire. Which, ultimately, we get that through wisdom. The wisdom that can differentiate what's happiness and what's not. Dharmakirti says, without losing belief in the object of an affliction, we can never abandon it. So that's really going to the root of it. Not, you know, belief in the object of an affliction, meaning without losing the fact without losing our belief in its inherent existence and its capacity to bring us happiness, we can't let it go. But in the meantime, there are some things, there are plenty of ways to work with this. Then from just a very recent teaching, in verse 133, Aryadeva says, desire arises from causes and also arises from circumstances. Desire arising from circumstance is easy to eliminate, but not the other. So what that means is, well, this was technically the term that Venerable said, a cause of similar type created by familiarity in the past. So desire arising from causes is like having the seed of desire in our mind. Meeting with an object, it's stimulated and the desire arises again. That's the one that he says, not easy to eliminate. And being beings in the desire realm, like whether desire is our principal mode or not, we have these seeds, it's going to arise. The other, desire arising from circumstance, is easy to eliminate. Easy being a relative term, I think. Circumstance means that the object sparks us. So if we're attached to baseball games, hearing the sound of cheering on somebody's TV activates our desire to watch the baseball game ourselves, like that. And so the antidote to that kind is to separate from the object, which sounds so sane. But when we're enthralled with the object, who the heck wants to separate from it? We had an interesting conversation. Some of the nuns went for a walk one day, and we were just talking about just this very thing, that somehow having come to the Abbey, living here, and it was in relation to attachment to people, partners, I think we were talking about. It's from when I sat in a relationship, listening to these teachings, to imagine separating from that relationship, even though I knew there was attachment, it was a good relationship. It was a good relationship. I couldn't, and I could not have imagined how it would feel to separate from it because I was so much a part of it. Until the separation came. Not at my instigation. That's when I actually started to pay a lot of attention to attachment and the pain of attachment. I think I was stunned at how painful it was. And also stunned to realize that when you start applying the antidote when you're in the throes of the suffering from not getting what you want, it's kind of late. It helps, but it doesn't relieve the pain for sure, which is what I wanted it to do. It didn't. But being in a situation now where we're quite separated from many of the things that cause so much attachment, it's a wonderful freedom feeling. You know, there's no, and following that same example, there's no thought in my mind, or as we were having that conversation, no thought in any of those people's minds, that a relationship would fulfill whatever we all thought it was going to do back when we had that attachment. But you couldn't have told me that before. It's only in the experience of having been separated from it and having that distance from any of those kinds of objects and having the precepts that prevent your mind from going there too, that that could be made clear. So I'm just actually sharing that just from understanding how difficult it is in our minds to separate from them. And to say that, I also need to emphasize, again, the teachings say over and over and over, it's not having a relationship is a problem. It's not that having nice things is a problem. It's not that having pleasure is the problem. Being with our friends, being with our loved ones is lovely. It's the glomming onto it and thinking it's going to last forever. That's the problem. That's our attachment. That's that thing in the very definition we had from the beginning for meditation on emptiness. Attachment is the mind that, like oil and cloth, gloms on to that object and can't be separated from it. That's the problem. And it's just so darn hard to see when we're in it. So, thinking about the disadvantages of attachment is antidote number one. The happiness that lets us down, the suffering that comes from indulging it, the suffering that comes from not getting what we want, all of the pain that comes with attachment. We have to spend time not on our feet, not, well, on our feet too, but on the cushion. We have to spend some analytical time really looking at, does this habit that I have been engaged in since the minute I was born and way before, that the whole society encourages, advertising, magazines, peers, like, there's no place that we can look that our desire isn't like pumped. No place in our whole society that doesn't pump it. So, you know, we really have to spend some time looking at it analytically and clearly from our own point of view, not trying to get everybody on board with us. Because only your Dharma friends are going to go there. And only if they're in the right frame of mind, our Dharma teachers will take us there. So that's one antidote. Looking at the repulsiveness or the ugliness of the object. When we're in the throes of attachment, this one actually is effective. With sexual attachment, you know, looking at the internal parts of the body of the being that we're attracted to, meditating on the rotting corpse that this body is going to become. So many people tell me, oh, I can't do that meditation. It's very effective. Very effective. Food, something that we're all attached to. You know, and Venerable very much talks about imagining that food. You chew it up, spit it back out. You want to put it back in your mouth now? It's a great visualization. Now it's in their stomach. Same food that you just took off the same table is in their gut. Do you want to eat it now? Looking at the repulsiveness of the object. Very effective. And then, when we've got that frame of mind, oh, attachment is a problem, then meditating on impermanence, again, before the separation occurs, that's actually the long-term antidote, to really look at the impermanence of all the phenomena around us. The things, the people, the ideas, our reputation, all of it. Changing, 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 changing. So we can enjoy it, but we can't hang on to it. There's nothing to hang on to. And the more we meditate on that about each different kind of phenomena, the clearer that gets. And again, Chagya Tulku Rinpoche is a lovely analogy. It says, imagine a child and an adult on a beach building a sandcastle. The adult doesn't think it's permanent or real and does not attach to it. The child, however, sees a real sandcastle, can probably imagine the colorful banners flying, and can probably imagine the knights and the ladies of the court going into the castle and out of the castle and all of that. The big wave comes. The child is devastated. The adult is not. Usually. Usually. I've seen some pretty invested adult sandcastle builders. But in general. So partly it's the belief in the permanence, and also partly it's the endowed with stuff. It's not just a sandcastle in the eyes of that kid. There are trumpets going. There's a fanfare playing. There's you know, there's horses, and, you know, the whole thing is there, completely projected onto this pile of sand. So we don't even just lose the building. We lose the whole reality when this thing comes. I mean, the whole structure, the whole fantasized existence. Boom. So by meditating on impermanence, getting really familiar with it, we lessen our attachment automatically. Automatically. This is again, it's Chagyur Tukku. Because we have believed for so long that our experience is stable and reliable, we have great attachment to it and suffer when it changes. Doesn't that sum it up? We have believed for so long that our experience is stable and reliable. And it's not! We wouldn't grasp at it if we didn't think that it was going to last, right? So if we maintain an awareness of the impermanence, then we are never completely fooled by the phenomena of samsara. It's a nice image that we're fooled all the time by the appearance of something's permanence. It's like one of the four distortions. It's one of the manifestations of the ignorance that is the, you know, the cause of our suffering. We're fooled by that appearance of permanence. And so if we really practice cultivating an understanding or an awareness that it's not permanent, that it is impermanent and changing moment by moment by moment, then our grip into it will not be so tight. Just a couple of more points that Chagyur Tukku Rinpoche gives as far as analysis. He says that as attachment arises and disturbs the mind, we can ask, why do I feel attachment? Is there any benefit to myself and others? Is the object of my attachment permanent and lasting? Then through this process, our desire begins to diminish. It's a simple question, simple analysis, but very probing. And then he says, as our practice matures, then we can go into it a different way, by really analyzing in the way that we've learned to look at our thoughts in general. So he says, especially if you're in the midst of a desire attack, you can't eliminate it by suppressing it. You won't eliminate it by following it or indulging it. So examine, where does it come from? Where does it dwell? How would you describe it? Does attachment have shape or color or form? When this thought of attachment disappears, where does it go? So it's a very, I mean, almost the same analysis that we do when we're just looking at our thoughts. But now we're looking at a thought with a particular color. The color of attachment. What is that color? What is that thought? You can say that desire exists, but when you start to look at it that way, it falls apart. You can't find it. And then it seems to dissolve. So, in summary, the Buddha gave us some really clear and effective ways to deal with this. And the Buddha taught so clearly what the problem with our attachment is. And all of the great teachers have expanded on, elucidated, elaborated, illuminated. And it's only our practice, it's only our experience, it's only our own, you know, meditation and analysis that will help us overcome it. knowing that as long as we are desire world beings, as long as we're under the influence of ignorance, our desire will arise. And having met these teachings, having the circumstances under which we can practice, we are so incredibly fortunate. I mean, if you look outside of our own existence and look at what craving, desire, greed has done to the world, it is a benefit to every living being. Any little bit of it we can get a handle on in our own minds. So, and as we've all commented, I'm sure people out there too have experienced that these teachings, these Aryadeva teachings, are just so penetrating. They're really taking stuff that we've heard before to a much kind of deeper place in our understanding. So I'm really grateful to have had the opportunity to have to study this a little bit this week, because it's been juicy for me. So thanks for the opportunity. Okay. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.